Well, good morning. Very good to have everybody here today. One of the questions that I'm often asked by young Christians in particular is, how do I know when I've found Mr. or Mrs. Right? How do I know when I've found the one? And this isn't just a lesson for young Christians, of course. Even as we get older and the years start adding up that we've been married, it's always good to go back and review maybe some of the things, the ideals that we had when we were young, some of the expectations that we had for ourselves as a spouse, the expectations that we had in finding a spouse or in dating. We need to make sure that we never get too comfortable as husbands and wives. We need to make sure that the bar that we set when we were young, that ideal that we had that we were going to find that one person who we wanted to spend our lives with, that one person who would make us feel complete, whole, and total, that high expectation that we had when we were young is something that carries on to the rest of our lives. Of course, one thing that we need to understand, first of all, is for the Christian, it's not about finding the one person who's going to complete you and make you feel whole and total. I think it's very true what I've heard in the past, that if you're not already a whole and total and complete person in God, you're never going to find completeness and totality in a spouse. Maybe that's one of the problems that we have starting off here in finding Mr. or Mrs. Right, is just this idea that we have that a husband or a wife is going to complete me and make me a total person. And well, that should never be that way. You need to be a complete person already. You need to be a person who's totally full, totally filled up on God first and foremost. Then you find someone who doesn't complete you, you find somebody who complements you. Somebody who complements the completeness that you already have in God. Now, when young Christians do ask a preacher or an elder or their parents, how do I know when I find the one? Oftentimes that preacher or elder or parent is not prepared to discuss that. Oftentimes the response is something like, well, you'll just know it when it happens, or the right one will find you, or if you're a mom or a dad, the response is often, as far as I'm concerned, there is nobody who's good enough for you. The Woodalls and us, we were just talking about that just last night, thinking about how hard it's going to be when we get to that point. They were mentioning that Andrew came home from school one day and he said, in his own words, a girl caught my eye today. How does a parent respond to that? First of all, how does a parent respond to that when your kid is like 7 or 8 years old? How does a parent respond to that when your kid is 17 or 18 or 20 years old? I think it doesn't seem like it gets any easier at that point. Though, I've always contended, there's nobody good enough for my daughters, but if there's anybody out there who's willing to live with Sterling, I'm just happy with that. Anybody is fine with me. Rather than avoiding the question of dating and relationships and marriage, rather than avoiding the subject with our young people, I think that we need to be very proactive in our conversations with them. We need to provide some substance to our responses of how do I know when I've found the one that I want to marry. Let's consider three applications before we jump into the main part of our lesson. Number one, once you've chosen a person to marry, there's no going back. There's no going back. Remember that once you've married somebody, that's it. That's it. Now, there's provision in the Bible for what to do when your spouse has been unfaithful to you. But, you know, when I've always done premarital counseling with couples, we spend almost an entire counseling session together dispelling the notion of divorce. It's the D word. Don't even say it. Don't even bring it up. Because if you never even talk about the D word, it doesn't become part of the conversation. Romans chapter 7, verses 2 through 3 makes it very clear that you're married to that person for life, that it's a lifetime commitment, that you're bound by law to that person that you marry. Matthew 19 and verse 6, a marriage is binding before God's eyes. And as long as those two people's lives coincide, they're bound by God, Matthew 19 and verse 9. Whether there's affection or not, there's a bond in God's eyes. And maybe we're seeing the side effects in our culture of maybe our dating culture in our very high divorce rates in this society. You know, when you think about dating for most people, and I think Christians can sometimes be included in this, but dating for most people is just shopping around. People are disposable. You know, you date someone for a month or 2 months or 3 months or 6 months or whatever, and they're disposable. And as soon as you find some fault, something that you don't like about a person, then you cut ties. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that you need to just date someone for the sake of dating, especially if that person is abusive or is a sinful influence on your life. But maybe part of our problem is when we start off in our dating relationships seeing people as disposable, we shouldn't be so surprised that that same disposability applies to marriage as well. We shouldn't be so surprised by that. And maybe we need to just teach our young people to be a little bit more discerning in their dating relationships before they get into marriage. Second application. You don't want to be the kind of person who says 20 years later, I wish I had known then what I know now about my spouse. Mr. or Mrs. Right might only seem right at the time because you're attracted to them or because you have only a superficial infatuation with a person. You need to know your spouse now. You need to know that who you're marrying now is going to be the same person 20 years from now. Or, at least in a sense, you need to be able to anticipate how that person might grow and mature and change over time, even 20 years from now. For Christians, and this is your third application, for Christians, marriage isn't just about avoiding mistakes. And I think maybe we have that attitude. We have the attitude that I just want to make sure I don't find somebody who's too bad. And you're thinking, oh, who has that attitude? I think it's kind of an unspoken sort of thing. Where we keep our expectations low so that we're not disappointed. We keep our expectations low because we don't think that we have a lot to offer or a lot to contribute. For the Christian, it's not just about avoiding the bad or avoiding mistakes. We need to have our sights set high, and we need to expect as much from our spouse, I think, as we should expect from ourselves. So maybe that's reflective as much as it is kind of outside of you. So let's consider in this lesson some very practical, some very specific, and I also think some very logical criteria to consider when it comes to marriage. And again, this isn't just about those who aren't married. This is about for us who've been married. Go back and look at who you were before you were married, when it was kind of that selling process, you know? When you're still selling the car. You got to be on your best behavior. You got to act right. You got to be the kind of person that somebody would want to marry. Well, ask yourself 10 years later, are you still the kind of person that if your spouse knew everything they knew now, if they knew it then, would they still want to buy the car? Would they still want to invest in you? The first thing I want to deal with is this notion of the one. Let's just dispel right now the notion that we are somehow cosmically directed to find our one and only soulmate in the search for a spouse. This is a very romantic idea, isn't it? You know, there's someone out there, and you might have seen him in kindergarten or something, then you get reconnected like 15, 20, 30 years later or something like that. Like, and there's just, you might brush up against him on the bus on the way to work. Your cars passed each other and like, that's the one for you. Let's completely dispel that notion right here and now. There is not just the one out there waiting for you. There is not just one. Well, somebody might respond, well, that's not very loving of you, Ryan. Well, what does Rebecca think of that idea of there's not just one person magically cosmically destined to find you. Okay, I'll concede. That doesn't sound like a very romantic idea, that there's not just one special person out there. And I get it. But you know what I think is also a very unromantic idea? Telling the divorcee that there's only one person out there for them. You know what I think is a really unromantic idea? Telling the widow or the widower that there was only one person waiting out there for them. I think that's actually a pretty insulting idea. To those who have been heartbroken, to go up to them and say, well, you had your shot, the universe gave you your one, and she died in a car wreck. The universe gave you your one, and he had an affair with his secretary. I don't think that's a very romantic idea. And so, you know, just because somebody doesn't believe in soulmates or cosmically directed one person out there, I think the alternative actually is much more practical and much more real than believing in soulmates. The first thing I want to notice here about finding the one is that we're not going to be married forever anyway. We're not going to be married for all eternity anyway. I'm not going to be married to Rebecca once I die, and she's not going to be married to me. Once one of us dies, that marriage is over. And we've talked about it before, and I think every couple should talk about it. Maybe here's kind of your practical advice for the day is every couple ought to have the conversation. But what's our expectation when one of us passes away? And I want Rebecca to marry somebody else. I do. I want Rebecca to marry somebody else if I pass away. And I want my kids to have a father figure in their lives. I want the stability that comes with that. I want that for my spouse. And I want that for my kids. Once I die, she's not married to me anymore. We all know from Matthew chapter 22 and verse 30, there's a lot of misconceptions that exist out there about marriage and how long it lasts and whether it's eternal or not. And Jesus' response to any of those kinds of non-biblical notions is, you don't know the scriptures very well, do you? His response to the Sadducees in Matthew chapter 22 was, you don't know the scriptures very well. If you knew the scriptures, you would know that they're neither given in marriage nor are married in the afterlife. This notion that you come with this hypothetical situation here in the context of Matthew 22 of one woman marries seven brothers and they each die in turn. Well, who's she married to in the afterlife? And Jesus goes, that's ridiculous. That's completely ludicrous to believe in that. You're like angels in the afterlife. Marriage does not extend beyond the physical life. If anything, I will actually know Rebecca better in the afterlife than I know her now. And again, these seem like very unromantic ideas to us. We're like, well, but I don't want marriage to end. And yet your marriage is going to be replaced by a deeper relationship in the afterlife. Imagine a relationship that has absolutely no physical component to it, where there is no physical that separates us. There's no physical that distracts us. There's no physical that keeps us from knowing each other as we truly are on the inside. And that's something that every saint is going to share with every other saint. In the afterlife, our relationships are not going to be based on the flesh. In the afterlife, our relationships are going to be based on the Spirit, with Jesus as the thing that unifies us. In Revelation chapter 19, verses 1 through 10, what is the thing that binds us together in the afterlife? It's not the physical. It's not a wedding ring. It's not a business relationship. It's not even blood between brothers and sisters. The thing that binds us in the afterlife is Jesus Himself. And I will trade all of the human relationships in the world, even the very best of human relationships, to share that with you and Christ for all eternity. With that being said, we need to define marriage as God defines it. We need to define marriage as God defines it. And He defines it as a very real thing. It should be real, not magical. And when a marriage bond is severed, whether by an act of adultery or tragedy, we should never look upon it with such sentimental gaze that we refuse to let love come back into our lives. Finding the one believing there's only one person out there, some soulmate for you, is a silly notion that keeps people grieving long after they should. Rebecca and I do not have a love that's unequaled in human history. We all want to think that, don't we? We want to be like our love is special. We love each other more than any other couple has ever loved each other. You know, Romeo and Juliet is ridiculous. Romeo, the idea of star-crossed lovers. You know all Romeo and Juliet are? They're a couple teenagers with bad communication skills. That's it. They're just a couple teenagers with bad communication skills. I promise you, I love Rebecca a whole lot more than Romeo and Juliet did. Because it's a real love. It's real. It's daily. The passion. You know, passion gets you so far, and passion has its place. Real love is daily life with somebody. Real love is lifetime commitment. Real love is real. And we need to keep marriages real. You can only go so far on Twitter patient. You can only go so far on being star-crossed lovers before that just kind of, the mileage runs out on that. That's why some marriages fail. And that's why a lot of marriages fail. Because you don't see marriage as a real thing. You don't keep it realistic and practical. Let's consider some examples here. Abraham, I believe, was very much in love with Sarah. They crossed the desert together. They went through thick and thin together. They experienced the heartache for decades of a couple that was unable physically to bear children. And they stuck with each other through thick and thin. And yet, when Sarah dies, he very much mourned her passing, Genesis 23 and verse 2, but still found another wife later in Genesis chapter 25, verses 1 through 8. Now, the burden of proof is on you to prove that Abraham didn't love Sarah. I think sometimes we have this silly notion, well, they just didn't love each other in the Old Testament. Marriages in the Old Testament were based on convenience or business decisions or political motives, or people were forced to marry each other because of family relationship. The burden of proof is on you to show me that Abraham didn't love Sarah. The burden of proof is on you to show that David was incapable of loving his spouse the way that we love each other now. The burden of proof is on you to show that they were incapable of loving each other in the olden days the way that we love each other now. Abraham loved Sarah. He was married to her longer than most of us are going to live. And yet Abraham remarried after she died. Other verses teach of the value of remarriage after widowhood. Go to 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 14. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 14, he says, "Therefore I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach." And he gives an explanation in verse 15, "For some have already turned aside to follow Satan." So there's a spiritual value there, that it keeps you from following Satan, keeps you from temptation. That's part of it. There's also a physical component to it. The physical component of the safety, the security of having a relationship like marriage. There's benefit there. There's benefit to remarrying. He speaks of it, if you want to write a couple other verses down, 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 39, Romans chapter 7 and verse 3, all allude to the value of remarriage after widowhood, that it is valuable. The same is true of one who's been heartbroken because of a spouse's infidelity. I guess I just don't want to go up to a divorcee and say that, well, that was it. You had your soulmate, and your soulmate broke your heart. Sorry. I think some people say, well, maybe it just wasn't Mr. Right at the time, or maybe it didn't turn out. Did you think he was Mr. Right when you first married him? On your wedding day, when everything looked good and there were wedding bells and everybody was happy, did you believe that he was Mr. Right on your wedding day? Yes, of course. Of course you did. Then he broke your heart. So again, is there just one person out there waiting for you to find him or her? Do you have just one shot at finding love? And if you miss it, Will you never be happy again? Of course, we should go into marriage with all the optimism in the world, with the attitude that we're only going to do it once. But I simply don't buy it that you'll never find love again if tragedy cuts short your marriage. The right person for you to marry is a man or woman who you can be completely transparent with at all times. By transparency, I mean honesty. Look at Romans chapter 12 and verse 9. Romans 12 and verse 9 says, "Let love be without hypocrisy." And it's been pointed out in previous lessons, but what does the word hypocrite mean? It comes from the Greek word hypokrites, which is a term that was applied to actors. They would exchange masks between acts. The same actor would play multiple parts in a Roman play. So he'd go off stage and put a different mask on. These masks even had devices built in them that would augment or change the sound of your voice. So it's not just that you would have a different face, it's that you have a different voice as well. You look different, you sound different. Let love be without hypocrisy. Let love be without acting, is what he's saying there. Let love be without multiple roles and multiple parts that you're playing. You don't have work Ryan and home Ryan. You don't have husband Ryan and father Ryan. You don't change your mask out depending on the situation. Well, there's the Ryan that I am around my buddies. There's the Ryan when I'm frustrated with life. There's the Ryan when I don't get enough sleep at night and I'm cranky. And then there's the Ryan on Saturdays when I'm watching football and leave me alone. There's not multiple masks that you put on. You're just yourself. The one person for you to marry, if you have to have that notion, is the person you can be totally honest around. Absolutely no hypocrisy. True love doesn't require you to be on your game at all times. So much of today's dating culture, however, is centered around appearing to be something that you're not. You show your best qualities, and they're all very carefully handpicked. I mean, it's the online dating. Like when you're putting together an online dating profile, are you going to talk about, you know, how your feet don't smell very good? Are you going to talk about like how you're prone to this bad habit? Are you going to talk about how, well, yeah, and I'm 31 years old and I still play video games all day long? Are you going to talk about your worst qualities? Or when you're putting together an online dating profile, do you carefully hand pick all of your best qualities? Of course you do. And that's where our culture gets it wrong when it comes to dating. We put on a persona. We put on an act. We turn on the charm. We sell ourselves. We sell an image. We sell a lifestyle. Let love be without hypocrisy, though. Be yourself. Now, I suppose that should be true of any situation, not just around a spouse, but around anybody. But consider a couple verses here, a couple Bible verses that give us something to think about here. You should want to marry someone who makes you feel comfortable enough to be yourself. You shouldn't feel the need to tiptoe around him or her when it comes to certain subjects, because marriage should be based on honesty. Go to Proverbs 9, verse 8 and 9. Proverbs chapter 9, verses 8 and 9. Beware of the man or woman who doesn't accept advice. Proverbs chapter 9, verses 8 and 9. Don't reprove a scoffer, lest he hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he'll love you. Give instruction to a wise man, he'll be still wiser. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase his learning. Be careful when you're dating somebody. Be careful about marrying the person who doesn't like accepting criticism. Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 5. Better is open rebuke than love that is concealed. Find the person who can take criticism and be honest about it. Life can become very sad when you're in a relationship that requires you to wear a fake smile all the time, or to live under the weight of looking and talking perfectly. Never marry somebody who you have to walk on eggshells around all the time. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4. We know the verse well. Keep the marriage bed holy. Part of holiness is honesty. That's what makes God holy. That's one of the hallmarks, the key characteristics of God is His honesty, holiness, purity. Let the marriage bed be holy as well. Proverbs 27 verse 17 says, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." There needs to be a spiritual growth component to your marriage. Does the person that you're with make you want to be better? Do you want to improve your spiritual life because of the influence of a potential mate? This is the kind of person who's right for you. When you find somebody who sharpens you as much as you have an opportunity to sharpen them, that's the kind of person that you want to marry. Now, sometimes when iron sharpens iron, sparks fly. Sometimes when iron sharpens iron, it can seem like an unpleasant process, a challenging, difficult process, and that's true as well. That's true as well. Don't give up on a relationship after the first argument. Don't walk away from each other when you're mad at each other all the time. I got some really good advice from a couple that had only been married about as long as we did, but they did something in their marriage that I thought was a really good idea. They said, if you're going to argue, hold hands with each other. Well, that was really good advice. Kind of keeps things under control, because it's hard to lash out at somebody who's got a firm grip on your hand. If you're going to argue about something, hold hands while you're arguing. And it kind of changes the tone of the conversation. Really, it keeps it from becoming a conflict, is what it is. In a good marriage that's strong, both partners keep each other honest by challenging each other. Notice that it says, iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. They're working together on this. It doesn't say that iron sharpens a man. It doesn't say that iron comes along and sharpens something else. It says they sharpen each other. They sharpen each other. You know, maybe there's a good piece of advice there as well, that if you're going to criticize your spouse, make sure that the criticism applies to yourself as well. That as you are sharpening your spouse, you're also being sharpened in the process too. You are being affected by the process as much as he or she is. Going along with that, you want to have success for each other. My mentor growing up told me, you want to marry your biggest fan. Marry your number one fan. You're never in competition with each other. Somebody once said that love does not consist in gazing at each other, but in looking the same direction. So a good question to ask of a potential mate or of yourself, if you're already married, is, does he or she want me to be all that I can be? Your spouse is never your competitor. Your spouse is never your enemy. Your spouse is never the one that you're fighting with for attention or resources or love or affection or physical satisfaction. Your spouse is never your competitor or your opponent. Your spouse is always your cheerleader in everything that you do that is righteous, at least. Your spouse is your cheerleader. Consider a couple verses here. The right person will see you as an asset and not a competitor, similar to what God says in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 5. Of course, this is going all the way back to the beginning when Jesus is talking about the relationship that's established in the Garden of Eden. But he says here in Matthew 19, 5, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." What does Ephesians chapter 5 say about one flesh then? In Ephesians chapter 5, speaking of the one flesh, he says in verse 28, "So husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ also does the church." Your right hand is never competing with your left hand. The top of your body is never fighting against the bottom of your body. Your head is never in conflict with your feet. They're working together in concert. It's one body. And if you and your spouse are one flesh, you're never fighting with each other. You're never against each other. You're always on the same page. One flesh is the language of total unity. I love in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, when Peter is talking to his audience about how to think of their spouses, how to think of their wives, he says, your wife is a fellow heir of the grace of God. Do you see your spouse that way? Do you see your spouse as a fellow heir of the grace of God? First and foremost, more than anything else, your spouse is a Christian. Your spouse is a believer. Your spouse is a fellow heir, and they need to be treated accordingly. Your spouse is a helpmeet, Genesis 2 and verse 18, a helper in the labors of life. You have one task that you're performing together. Proverbs chapter 31. I like the way that these two things work together. Go to Proverbs 31 and notice that as one partner works, the other one works as well, that their labors are kind of intertwined with each other. It says in Proverbs 31, 11 and 12, the heart of her husband trusts in her, and he'll have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. Now that's true of the worthy woman here in Proverbs 31, but I think it works both ways as well. He trusts in her. He doesn't have to micromanage her. In the same way, she does her work as she ought to. And she never needs to be micromanaged. They have their roles in their marriage and they're working together in concert. So do you want success for your spouse? Do you really want success for your spouse? And maybe a practical application is, do you get jealous when your spouse succeeds at something? Do you get jealous when your spouse wants to take up a hobby and is actually good at a hobby? Do you become envious at things that your spouse does, friends that your spouse has? Sometimes I think we have this sense that we want to keep our spouses down. Because as long as they're up, it motivates us to go up as well. As long as they're down, it can keep us lazy as well. The last point that we'll make this morning, and this is the doozy. This is the, I think, this most challenging part of this lesson. Is he or she a Christian? I'm often asked this, Ryan, what do you think of a Christian marrying an unbeliever? Is that okay? Is that wrong? What does the Bible have to say about it? Am I committing a sin? Is that, what do we do about the Christian who marries the unbeliever? Some people kind of have a hard and fast rule about it, kind of in their minds. It's a set subject. Other people don't seem to care about it at all. And I will tell you this. First of all, I can't point to any conclusive Bible passage that prohibits marrying an unbeliever. But there are several serious concerns that we ought to keep in mind. The first is this. Don't assume that just because you marry an unbeliever, that he or she is just going to automatically or eventually or most likely become a Christian at some point. I think we have this assumption like, well, you know, I'll work on them over the years. It's a foregone conclusion that, you know, someday, eventually, more than likely, he'll come around or she'll come around. I think we need to remember something about people. People are individuals. They have free will. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 16 makes it clear that not every unbelieving spouse is going to become a Christian. And he addresses that in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. He talks about to the person who is married to the unbeliever. Don't assume that they're just going to change automatically. Don't assume that it's just a foregone conclusion. You are married to a free will individual who may or may not ever become a Christian. Try not to make excuses for that person also. Try not to make excuses. Well, he's close. I think he's close to it. Or she's still just studying. Or I'm just going to be a good influence and see what happens. Ask yourself, are you actually evangelizing that person? Maybe that's, we kind of like forget that stuff. Like, well, he'll become a Christian someday. Why? Because of what? Are you reading your Bible at home? Does he see you praying? Does he know that when it comes to worship on Sundays, Bible class on Wednesdays, there is absolutely, positively no compromising for you? Are you talking about gospel matters with him or her? Are you actually inviting them to sit down and study with you? Don't just assume that your magical influence is going to do the trick. Let's kind of wrap things up here with 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning in verse 14. Do not be bound together with unbelievers. For what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? What harmony has Christ with Belial? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God. We are the temple of the living God. Let's not discount, though, the possibility of dating or marrying an unbeliever. Because I'm sure there's people in this room right now who are saying, tell you what, if I hadn't married that Christian, I never would have become one. And it's because of the influence of that believing spouse that you ever heard the gospel at all. So I'm not discounting that. I can't say there's some hard and fast rule, some clear-cut Bible passage that says don't or do it. But I always just try to keep in mind 2 Corinthians 6. If your spouse is not on the same page with you spiritually, it's only going to present roadblocks and speed bumps along the way of life, in raising your own kids, in making moral choices for your kids, of what do we do with the prom, what do we do with drinking, What do we do with limitations, with rules, with boundaries? You don't think that's ever going to be a problem? You don't think that two differing worldviews are ever going to butt heads on moral questions of how to raise kids, of how to spend your money, of how to live in your marriage? Keep those things in mind before entering into a relationship with an unbeliever. Because life is not made easier by it. Life is made more challenging by it. So we'll go ahead and put it this way. I know this isn't a lesson that's going to have you all, you know, clamoring down the aisles to be baptized, but we want to offer an invitation to make sure you know that every worship service comes with the opportunity. Every time we gather together in an assembly, we are providing an opportunity for you to be baptized. If you've not been living after the way of Christ, then you've not been living right. You've been living in darkness, like we talked about last week, light versus darkness. Now is your opportunity to make things right. Now is your opportunity to live for Him, to make the decision once and for all to become a Christian, to put the life of sin behind you and live evermore for Him. If you're an unbeliever and you're married to a Christian, please consider this not just an opportunity to make your marriage stronger by being of the same faith. Make sure you're doing it for you. Because you need God. You need Christ. So whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.